History of Persia is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Yeah, we're now finally getting to what is sort of his purpose of this book, which is to explore the idea of creation. And Cyrus Potama, our main character, who is supposedly the mouthpiece of Zoroastrian thought, doesn't even have the level of explanation or detail that Zoroastrianism had at the time.
There's this weird dancing around one of the ancient explanations. And it's not one that's stuck around in modern Zoroastrianism, because it is sort of a reformist idea from like the 300s AD. But one of the things that Cyrus Potama brings up repeatedly is that this idea of time of the long dominion, which is the current period of existence that Ahura Mazda and Ahriman and the material world exist in, and how that was born out of endless time. And these are actual concepts in Avestan, but they're usually not translated. It's another one of those things where him translating the terminology kind of works against him, because the word for time in Avestan is Zervon. And if you've played Crusader Kings 2, one of the...
And 3.
Subsects of Zoroastrianism is Zervanism, and this is an actual movement that existed at some point in probably Parthian history, where they took this first concept of Zervon and made it a personified god of time, who was boundless or endless or infinite and without direction or shape, and then created, or through the mixing, meshing flow of time, generated the existence of good and evil in the form of Ahura Mazda and Ahriman. And what's really weird about this, and maybe it's just because I got back into Skyrim this past week, it's like word for word the lore of like the existence of the Elder Scrolls universe. It's like Michael Kirkbride just took this concept and planted it directly into his writing. Down to, and I shit you not, Zervon is described as Akka, like Akatosh. There's infinite Zervon, which is the kind of the primordial soup that is personified in one version of Zoroastrianism, but is present in all of them, you know, and it's present in all strains of Zoroastrian thought, because it's in the Gathas. And then in what Cyrus calls Time of the Long Dominion is linear Zervon. It's linear time constrained by the flow of events. And there's all sorts of millenarian traditions and cosmology that goes into that. That's not important here. But those concepts are in there, but he doesn't use them. They're just because he reduces this semi-divine concept of Zervon to the time before and the time that is right now, there's no agency to it, and there's no action to it. So you can't use it to explain anything. It's just a description. And just one of my favorite fun facts about Zervon is that the Chinvat Bridge, that is the crossing from life to death in Zoroastrian tradition, is said to be built by Zervon. So the passage from life to death is built by time, which I just think, like, real on the nose.
Again, subtext is for cowards.
Exactly. But, like, that's one of those things where Zervon is an actor. You can use that to help explain creation, and he just doesn't.
Yeah, what we're getting at here is that...
But, of course, you can then work back to, like, where did Zervon come from, but...
But yeah, I would say what we're getting at here is the fact that even though Vidal uses Zoroastrianism as the lens through which his main character debates other figures on creation, he at base is not doing justice to the explanations that Zoroastrianism itself offers to this question. Like, the main character, essentially, Cyrus Potama, never, like, stands up for himself or his grandfather in these debates with, you know, the Buddha or whoever. Like, he doesn't even do himself and his own faith justice, because I think that's just a failing of the author. Vidal himself can't do Zoroastrianism justice.
Yeah, and part of me wonders if, in addition to the colonial baggage of making Zoroastrianism monotheistic, if he might have felt like the actual Zoroastrian cosmogony was too sci-fi to put in his historical fiction novel. Because it sounds like a very modern conception of non-linear time.
Yeah.
So, like, it does kind of stand out if you try to put it in an ancient context, which, again, is one of those things that's just, like, interesting to me about Zoroastrianism, that, like, they were just like, yeah, time, it's a big ball of timey-wimey stuff. And then Ahura Mazda stretched it out into a line, and we're gonna live on that line until it ends, and then it goes back to being a mess. Like, but, like, that's not what people think of when they think of antiquity. Yeah.
I mean, it's that sort of thing that actually drew me to Zoroastrianism in the first place. That there are relatively, you know, again, what we'd feel like in context, modern interpretations of the universe, and for me personally, you know, morality, that you don't expect from something that was created, you know, before the Persian Empire.
I'm rapidly skimming over an Encyclopedia Iranica article to see if there's anything that, like, I'm not thinking of that would explain this, and it really just seems to be, like, either he was married to the monotheistic angle or didn't like the framing of the actual cosmogony, because that's the only story that's provided of where does Ahura Mazda come from is non-linear time is chaotic and just spawned the concepts of good and evil. But, you know, since that's the baseline that we as the audience and Cyrus as the protagonist are working off of, that is the baseline that he encounters Hinduism and Buddhism and Jainism and Confucianism and Taoism through, and Greek philosophy, but it's mostly there to make fun of Greece.
Yeah, I don't know if that's simply Vidal committing to the bit of being a Persian noble, or if those are just actually his views, but he really leans into dunking on the Greeks constantly. So I don't know if that's just a narrative choice for the story, or if Vidal really does just hate Greece that much, but he goes all in.
No, I think it must be a narrative choice, because he kind of fawns over Greco-Roman philosophy and Julian, because he makes Julian the apostate the main character.
That's true.
And obviously, like, that's a big Platonism guy. So I think part of that is just committing to the bit of Cyrus making fun of the Greeks constantly.
It is fun.
Which, fair. Like,
it is fun. It is one of the, like, the fun things I enjoy throughout the novel. Whenever he has to mention the Greeks, he's like, oh, these fucking Greeks. Anyway, India was cool.
I like, one of the constant refrains is that the Greeks are fundamentally incapable of doing things right because they have to lie to make a living. Which is also just a dig at capitalism, and I'm here for it.
He very much makes them, yeah.
He's like, yeah, in the East, we all just, like, we either own farms or work on farms, and that works fine. What are all these markets for?
He's like, what if we all just, like, made food and lived together, and these duplicitous Greeks need to make money all the time? And you're like, okay. Not even a thinly veiled capitalism might not be good for us type deal.
Yeah. No, just people who have to work in markets are inherently more evil because they lie all the time. That's not even what the lie all caps means in theology. And the book acknowledges that the rest of the time, but he uses it to make fun of Greece. So yeah, like, most of the stuff about the Greek philosophers, especially Anaxagoras and his meteor, are just trolling, yeah, basically. But when you get into the, Dharmic religions, which is massively inaccurate, but also broadly works for philosophical reasons, he keeps having Cyrus be massively irritated with how really these four big Chinese and Indian religions just don't care.
Yeah. About the concept of creation. They simply don't care.
Like,
it's not important.
And I like how he progresses that story, though, because he starts by introducing Hindu characters. And obviously, or, you know, Vedic characters. And he actually does draw that distinction that I usually don't bother with. Because, yeah, obviously the Vedas and Zoroastrianism are very similar, except the Vedas aren't as choosy about their gods. So it's just a difference of theological opinion, like what is right practice. But then that's used as kind of a gateway into Buddhism and Jainism. And Cyrus is just constantly frustrated with, why don't you people want to know the answer to my question?
Why don't you care as much about answering this question as I do?
Yeah. And I'm not an expert on Indian or Chinese religion or philosophy, so I'm not super well qualified to interrogate how accurate his portrayal of, like, Buddhist creation myths are. But he does seem to be fairly accurate in that to Buddhism, time is cyclic and that doesn't really matter because your goal is to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And to someone who is committed to a religious belief in linear time ruled by a deity, that way of thinking is just maddening.
He Vidal does do a good job, I think, specifically with the Buddha and his right-hand man, whose name I don't remember offhand,
I tried to find it, but he's just called Cyrus's companion most of the time.
Yeah, but like, of just, you know, of like the of him asking the Buddha a question and the Buddha just being like, my answer is that I don't have an answer to that. It doesn't matter. And Cyrus is like, but it does matter. It does matter where it started and where it's going. And the Buddha is just like, why would I care? I've already ascended beyond your whole concept of time and existence. So where it started and where it ends does not matter to me. You know, as the book says, he is the one who has come and gone. Where it starts and ends is no longer important. And that is entirely frustrating for Cyrus Pitama to try and deal with. Which, I mean, to be fair, if you're very, like you said, you're very committed to the idea of linear God-controlled time, that could be a very frustrating non-answer.
Yeah, one of the things that Cyrus complains about the Buddhists in particular is that they're willing to just accept all of the gods. You know, they don't care if it's a Zoroastrian god or a Hindu god or a Chinese god or a Scythian god. They're just like, yeah, sure, that one exists. And of course, like, regardless of how monotheistic you want to portray it, Zoroastrianism definitely does have a short list of gods you are not supposed to worship. Somewhat ironically, the Buddha ended up on there eventually.
But also, I mean...
Yeah. Budi, who is worshipped in idols in India.
I do think... You could correct me. I could be wrong about this. But I do think, though, that Zoroastrianism, again, talking about real life versus the way it's portrayed by Vidal, does... at least in the modern day, have more of a, yeah, there are could be other gods. You probably shouldn't worship them, but there are sort of deal. Then, you know, sort of this righteousness that Vidal portrays Cyrus Pitama as having.
Yeah. It's not as open as Buddhism because the concept of daivas does still exist. But, like, there are... God's names mentioned in various parts of the Avesta with no context whatsoever. Some of them are the titles of the Yashts, like I don't remember which one it's actually about, but one of the Yashts is the Rama Yasht, and it has like one line about a Yazada named Rama, as in like the Ramayana in India. Like the same concept. But like a being who in Hindu tradition is an incarnation of Shiva or of Vishnu, and in some sects the ruler of the universe, is just like a passing name in one Zoroastrian verse. So there's definitely an understanding that there's other gods who aren't named explicitly. You shouldn't go trying to find them in other religions so that you can bring them back, because that's kind of the whole antithetical to the whole point. But like, that's definitely an idea, and certainly like there's the idea of the Fravashis, the kind of minor personal gods that are somewhere between like a guardian angel and a Roman household god, that are, you know, there's one of those for every person.
Yeah.
You know, near infinite, basically. So it's not that there's not more gods, it's just that the Buddhists, and this is something that I kind of wish Vidal had interrogated more instead of just bringing up in passing, because I think it's really interesting, that in Buddhism, because the goal is to achieve nirvana and die and leave the cycle of reincarnation, you can be reincarnated as a god, but if you're reincarnated as a god, you become immortal. So even if you achieve nirvana, you can't die, and you can't get out of the cycle. So, one, the idea that all gods are potentially reincarnated mortals, I feel like would have caused Cyrus's head to explode. And two, like, provides a really interesting contrast to the question about creation, which he only really interrogates as the, like, the cyclical nature of time.
Yeah, you're right. He does only bring that up briefly. The fact that, like, the Buddha or one of the other Buddhists mentions that, like, you know, the other Hindu gods or whatever, sure, they're there, whatever, but the Buddha's already above them because they can't actually achieve nirvana because they can't die. So they can't be reincarnated or do any better. So they just sort of are and are stuck as the way they are. Or like you said, are possibly reincarnated mortals who now are stuck up there. But that calls into question how a god could die and a bunch of other things that Vidal just doesn't interrogate at all, in lieu of using his space to give us more stories about bathhouses in Babylon.
Yeah, and in case anybody's wondering why we keep bringing the weird sidetracks in Babylon up, it's because they're weird and kind of annoying. One of them is largely about Xerxes getting laid by a temple priestess. a practice that archaeologists no longer think existed, but again, 81. But like, there's no reason that needed to be a large part of the book. That's a section you could have given to Ezra. Come on.
That we could have been talking to Ezra instead of the second time we're in Babylon.
The other side of the kind of Indian journey is when he's talking to the Jains. And I pulled this quote because I think it's just very funny and, you know, kind of enlightening. So Cyrus explains how there was nothing and then there was God, and then God created things and God created himself through sheer force of being Ahura Mazda. And the quote goes, "How very complicated," said Ananda. "And so typical of those supreme deities. All that malice, all that silliness. After all, if he is supreme, why does he allow evil to exist?" And Cyrus has the only good comeback to that question that could possibly exist, and is the reason I got interested in reading about Zoroastrianism in the first place, so that each man can make his choice.
It's the reason, one of the large reasons this is the faith that I converted to, is because to me, it is the only one that not only allows for, but encourages the idea of free will and free choice in your actions.
It's not even encourages. This is a fundamental principle to the universe. It is part of the definition of being good, is having free will.
To be good, you yourself must make the choice to be good. You don't have to. No one is going to make you. But if you wish to be good, it is a thing that you must choose for yourself. Which, if we're getting personal again, is one of the things that spoke to me, you know, as a person and as, you know, someone of the who has the politics that I do. If you want to do good and be good, those are choices that you yourself must make. They cannot be imposed upon you, because then they're not genuine.
And I don't remember what the academic word for it is. The study of the origin of evil is this whole big section of theological studies. And Zoroastrianism is, in my experience, one of the only ones that has a clear and concise, simple answer to it. Because Ahura Mazda makes creation, and Ahura Mazda says, here's the bullet point list of things that are good, and one of those things is free will. And you don't have to carry the argument on beyond that. And I think that's one of the reasons that this isn't a bigger theme in the book. Because I feel like if you took any of the other religious communities, Cyrus meets with all of the religious leaders, but they also all have like a sidekick who does most of the talking for them.
Which side note, coming as the literary podcaster, I want to say that's a very clear, specific choice he made to not to put too many words directly in the mouths of famous attested historical figures. He doesn't want to put too many words directly in the mouth of the Buddha or of Confucius. It's much safer to have like interpretations and debates happening with a second in command or a sidekick or a follower, because then there's like it's sort of like making the main character Cyrus as opposed to Zoroaster. You sort of remove it by a step to make the conversations more possible.
Yeah, and I do believe that at least for Confucius, a large number of the things that he actually puts into his mouth are quotes from literature, which I would guess is true for the others as well. I just am not as well versed in.
From what I've read and studied of Buddhism, a lot of the stuff the Buddha says is, if not a direct quote, is very much like this is a thing specifically elucidated by the Buddha, you know?
Right. So yeah, definitely a very safe choice. But I think if you took any of those other sidekick characters and made them the one traveling the world, the origin of evil, like the role of evil in creation, would have to be a much bigger part of the theme. Because Cyrus is able to shut it down really easily every time it comes up.
Yeah, because he has, like you said, an answer. And not a complicated one.
Honestly, that's another one where I'm like, I really wish there was a Judaism section, because like it would be interesting, because there's so much rabbinical literature trying to explain this that you could just quote directly into characters' mouths.
Again, talking about a group of people who were fanatical about having those conversations and writing them down. Like, rabbinical text is just rabbis reading and writing notes about each other's interpretations back and forth for forever.
Yeah, honestly, if it's something that you think is neat and you want to kill a couple of hours, pick up some rabbinical literature and read through how people have tried to desperately stretch interpretations of the Torah to cover modern life.
It's so good.
Because, like, either you're a believer and it's ingenious, or you're not, and it's just amusing. Like, the way you have to reread and reinterpret things over time, and bear in mind that they're not Christian. In Judaism and most other religions, including Zoroastrianism, it's perfectly valid to reinterpret exactly what the scripture says and not be a constitutional originalist.
Yeah, it is common and somewhat accepted to over time look back and go, I don't think that's what that meant. Or I need to find a meaning for this that actually applies to what's happening to me now. Which is something that, you know, you see sort of Christian fundamentalists, you know, or, you know, what do you call them? Originalists or whatever, like, not big fans of.
Right. And like, do I think Hasidic Jews not being allowed to use light switches on a Saturday is kind of silly? Yes. Is it does it stem from a very real interpretation of how incandescent light bulbs work and how that interplays with scripture? Also, yes. Like, it's it is making scripture a living document instead of an ancient text, which is something that I think American Christianity in particular has always really struggled with. But we talked about, like, there's a reform movement in Zoroastrianism. It's the same thing. It's saying, like, okay, we have all of this stuff. Well, it's about people living in as nomads in Central Asia. How does that apply to what we're doing now? And it's very interesting to read through some of that and, you know, see how people interact with religion in a way that isn't about reading it literally. Especially as someone, you know, raised in white Christian America.
Yeah, as many of us were.
The thing we haven't talked about, and I think partly because I kind of doubt either of us are super well versed in it to be very insightful, is the Chinese section of creation.
Yeah, I gotta be honest.
But it's actually a really long part of the book.
Yeah, it is. But like you said, I gotta be honest, I'm not super familiar with sort of the Confucian tradition of, you know, besides, you know, general principles in the day to day, like getting into, again, the big question, creation. It's just not something that we, you know, come across in America very often, and not something we're well versed on. Now, I think if we tried a little harder, we probably could have come up with some Taoists, some people that are much more familiar with the Taoist way of conceiving of that sort of thing. But still, it's something you got to go out of your way to find in the U.S.
Yeah. The part of the reason the Chinese section is so long is also, it almost feels like a novella embedded inside the book. Like, he wanted to do a Warring States period Chinese novel and just didn't feel like he had the time or enough material or something, so it merged with creation. Because a large part of it is Cyrus getting caught up in the Qin conquest of northern China. which is interesting and, you know, kind of acts as a parallel and a bookend with the Greek Wars, because they're actually kind of very similar places at the time. But he just kind of like runs into Confucius and Lao Tse while getting shuttled around between political conflicts.
But you're right. It sort of has this feel of like the novel would almost be a little more, well, bearable in length and more complete if he had simply gone to India and then like come back and then gone off to Athens to go, you know, for the Greek Wars to end and for him to become an ambassador to Athens and stuff. Like the whole in Cathay part feels, like you said, like it was sort of inserted into the novel because he didn't know what else to do with it. You know, he even could have talked to Chinese philosophers and stuff, but even as he gets introduced to them, you could have met some of them in India. Like they were there doing trade. So you didn't have to do the whole warring states interlude.
Well, that's kind of the funny thing, though, is that they weren't really, partly because it was the warring states period and China was busy at the time. But it's the most ahistorical part of the book because there's not contact between China and, you know, really anything west of modern Xinjiang until the Parthian period.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, because what's now Xinjiang province, and the reason, and, you know, still part of the reason that Xinjiang is culturally very different from China, despite Xi Jinping's hopes and dreams, is that it's central, you know, it's Central Asia, and it's just inside China's borders now. It has been for a very long time, but it's always been more geographically and culturally alike to the places on the western side of the mountains than the eastern side of the mountains. Like the Chinese beat the Xiongnu, a great big steppe empire, like kind of like Mongols 1.0, and the Xiongnu turn around and beat these people called the Yueshi, who run to Central Asia. And around the same time that I want to say it's the Han Dynasty is invading the Tarim Basin, which is most of modern Xinjiang. And they're like, well, where the hell did they go? So the first contact between like Iranian peoples and China was the Chinese emperor sending someone to be like, where did all those people we were fighting run away to? We didn't think there was anywhere for them to go over there. And like, that's how they discovered that Bactria exists. But like there had been hostile nomadic cognates in between for so long that there wasn't contact, at least not directly. Like we have Persian rugs in Siberia from trade, but no direct personal accounts of any sort, and not even like references to place names.
I could be wrong, but I feel like that is one thing Vidal does try to get across a little bit, is the fact that like even though theoretically someone in Persia and someone in China could be aware that the other place may exist, it was so functionally far beyond their world that for all they know, there might not be anything over there. And so the idea of the Chinese, of the Han Dynasty, sending out something like, where'd those people go? We didn't think there was anything out here for them to run away to, kind of makes sense. And for them to get there and be like, huh, there's people here.
If you think about it from like the ancient Chinese perspective that's centered on the Yellow River, if you go north, it's desert and mountains and steppe. If you go west, it's mountains and steppe forever. If you go south, it's the Himalayas.
Or the jungle of Southeast Asia.
Like, those seem like the world is just... Yeah, and that's not that far. You can sail around it and, you know, and it's just trees forever. Like, you know, you've got ocean and desert and mountains, and they're the biggest mountains in the world. It really feels like the world's just trailing off. So when they finally get far enough west that they're in the part where they think the world's trailing off, like, well, wait, where are people going? We thought it was just endless grassland forever. They didn't know that there were big, powerful kingdoms on the other side of the mountains. Because I think people really... In a world where we have helicopters, really don't get how impassable the mountains in Southern Asia really are. Like, they thought, the Greeks thought they were the end of the world while they were standing
there. They were at them, and they were like, yeah, I don't think there's anything on the other side of those. I think that's it. We can't get over there. And I don't think we want to try.
And, you know, the Graveyard of Empires line is a myth to make the Russians and the Americans feel better. But, like, there's a reason that is a hard place to be a military. Like, it is hard to get around. And really what all of this comes back to is this would really have just been another place where you really should have had a Jewish section instead of trying to, like, do the entire Warring States period in it as a subsection of your book.
I was going to say, he could have had a Jewish section. He even could have had an Egyptian section. The Egyptian gods and theology had been around for a very long time at this point. And he doesn't touch it at all. Like, the Persians were very aware that the Egyptians had their own gods and cosmology, or whatever you want to call it, for basically forever. And he just doesn't bother with it. Instead, he's like, we're going to go to the Yellow River because it seems more exotic.
All right. And, you know, like, there's actually, like, a reason for him to include Egypt, too. Like, there's a rebellion as soon as Xerxes comes to power. Like, have Cyrus tag along. They're friends. Like, though I had to double check this because I kind of had a hunch that this was going to be the case. The ideal Egyptian character, his tomb was discovered in 1980. So the person I immediately thought of, and I was like, oh, that would be perfect, is Wejoharesnet, who was this Egyptian priest and physician and admiral who helped Cambyses conquer Egypt and then worked for Darius for a long time. But they didn't know he existed until the book was already published.
And that would have been a perfect character for Cyrus to, like, sail around for Cyrus Potama to, like, hang out with and sail around the Mediterranean or something.
Honestly, I would love to see a book about all of the foreign doctors who hung out at the Achaemenid court, because there's a bunch of real interesting people.
Vidal does talk a lot about the one Greek doctor. What's his name?
Oh yeah. Well, cause Democedes is in there. Because he does Atossa's mastectomy. First documented case of breast cancer and surviving breast cancer all in one go.
Well, I mean, if Vidal is to be believed, it's because Atossa was a witch and a follower of Anahita.
Yes, well, I think that's also if Atossa can be believed. The book very much goes out of its way to have her present herself that way. And Anahita's the other religious thing that grinds on me here, because he makes it like, oh, she's clinging to this old idol. Anahita was new. Like, they kind of made her up during the Achaemenid period. Like, not that Anahita didn't exist before, but, like, she was an aspect of Aban, or, like, a handmaiden to a different Yezada. But she was so similar to Ishtar that she was really popular. I routinely wish that I knew more languages. Even right in the middle of the US, I run into Spanish speakers all the time, and my social media always has a little Persian, Arabic, some Dutch, and German. Rosetta Stone does help. It's the most trusted language learning program, after all. It's also conveniently available on desktop or on the go as an app, and has some really cool features that truly immerse you in the language you're learning. Just the first steps, like learning a new alphabet and some simple phrases, helped open new doors, and Rosetta Stone is a great choice as the trusted expert in this for 30 years and millions of users with 25 languages available to learn.
They focus on fast language acquisition without English translations to help you learn, speak, listen, and think in your new language while building long-term retention. Their true accent speech recognition also gives feedback on pronunciation, which can be really important for languages like Persian, where how you say something is very important. And on top of being available for desktop and mobile, you have the option to download lessons and take them offline. This is also all available at a steal. You can get lifetime membership, all 25 languages, for 50% off. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, History of Persia listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
But yeah, so I think that's the last thing to talk about here is Atossa and the harem. I feel like we got to include that.
Yeah, it is one of the last, I want to call sort of glaring historical inaccuracies of the novel, but it also comes with the caveat that we've been giving for a number of things, the fact that the book sort of, and the research reinventing how we view harems and the women of the Achaemenid period hadn't happened yet.
Yeah. And there's kind of two things to that. On one hand, Maria Brosius's debut, absolutely essential reading, really needs to be republished with translations of the German so that it can be accessible book that I have right here to read the title. Women in Ancient Persia, 559 to 331 BC, from Clarendon Paperbacks, was published in 1996. It is the book on women in the Achaemenid period and did a lot to rewrite how we talk about and perceive them. But it's not like this book came out of a vacuum either. Like, Brosius was just pulling together individual bits of research that had existed for decades. And that only covers so much, because Vidal goes hard on the harem. Like, he just copies and pastes the Ottoman system directly into ancient Persia.
Yeah, the whole women are completely locked away. No one can have contact with them except eunuchs. Like, it's this back rooms of conniving and backstabbing. It's where power actually happens, because the women and eunuchs secretly control everything. Sometimes men literally never see them ever. And just like you said, that's like an Ottoman thing, which is a whole other empire, a whole other time, and a whole other religion.
Yeah. It is 2,000 years later. It would be like someone trying to describe American sexual, modern French sexual politics by comparing it to the Roman Empire. Like, they're not the same time and place, and they're not similar. And, you know, you can excuse some of it because Brosius's book wasn't out yet. And she probably wasn't even in grad school yet, but A.T. Olmsted dismissed a lot of the popular harem mythology and sexual orientalism in 1948, and it's one of the most popular books about ancient Persia to this day. I guarantee he read it when he was writing, when he was researching for this novel.
And just chose not to use it.
In favor of the Greek. And on it, like, he's even worse than the Greeks, actually. Like, the Greeks at least occasionally give credit to the women for, like, going out in the world and doing stuff. Women are locked away with the small children and only seen to have sex. Like, that's the only time it's ever implied, like, formal gatherings and sexual encounters. And, you know, listeners of my podcast know that's not how it worked. Noble women had their own estates and traveled and, you know, were sometimes the highest ranking royal official in Persepolis for major religious festivals and presided over them in the king's place. Like, it's just not what this, like, it's the most inaccurate thing in the book. Like, I would say it's more inaccurate than completely rewriting the timeline of Zoroastrian history.
I might, like, be wrong about this, but I don't remember eunuchs being nearly as big a deal in the Achaemenid court as Vidal makes them out to be. Or am I just misremembering that?
So if your primary exposure to the Achaemenid period is me, you're not misremembering. That's partly because I don't emphasize them nearly as much as the source material does, because I'm kind of doubtful of how the Greeks use eunuchs. And I don't always mention when people are eunuchs in my narrative because it's not relevant. Like, why the hell do I care whether or not the guy running a sub-region of Armenia has balls? The Greeks include it because eunuchs are schemy, schemy people who can't be trusted.
To the Greeks.
Yeah, to the Greeks. Because fundamentally, to the Persians, most of the eunuchs who show up are, like, royal advisors. Like, obviously, they're very trusted people. But the Greeks are like, I can't predict that he's gonna be easily manipulated by wanting to get laid, so must not be trustworthy.
Not like, overcome by sexual desire at the slightest moment. How can I trust this person?
Which, honestly, like, if when you start reading about ancient Greek cultures, like, yeah, that checks out. Like, that is an overriding factor of both Athens and Sparta all the time. Have I put out the episode where what's his name is obsessed with his lover's and beautiful kisses?
He misses his boy's beautiful kisses. I you might have put that out. I remember editing that one recently.
Yeah, like, I know I've sent it to you, but I don't remember if I have it back or not. Regardless, like, yeah, like, the Greeks are just really horny all the time. And therefore they don't trust the people who aren't. I don't bring it up all the time. I'm going to do an episode where I talk about the role of eunuchs and the role of people considered servants in general near the end, because I need to, like, patch out time to give Artaxerxes IV mm-hmm. his fair share.
But I mean, again,
because, like, he actually only lives for, like, a day. But
again, the idea of this, like, prevalence of scheming, of, like, scheming eunuchs, to me has the same stink of making, of using the harem the way the, of making the harem Ottoman. These, like, scheming court eunuchs that secretly run everything seems much more Eastern Roman Empire and Byzantine to me than it does seem Persian.
Oh, the whole thing's extremely Byzantine. Like, that's the Ottomans just copied the Byzantine system. I don't remember.
The Ottomans kind of did a Persian thing.
The women's quarters.
Where they just took over and were like, what are the rules here? What are the rules here? We're just going to do those now.
Yeah, the Anatolian Turks early on, like, before the Ottoman Empire was a world power, kind of took, like, a Persian aesthetic and plastered it over a Roman system, and that's the genesis of modern Turkey.
And only good things have come since then.
With, you know, no offense on that count to my Turkish listeners, if you exist. I have other things I'll offend you with some other time. But I would also wonder with the eunuchs, you know, there's their role in Greek literature, which is definitely a big influence. I'd also kind of wonder if it's Vidal's weird gender and sexuality opinions.
Could be.
Leaking through. Because there's always a non-standard sexuality associated with eunuchs. Because there kind of has to be. Sometimes it's that they occupy a kind of third gender role. Sometimes it's that just that they can't reproduce and therefore can't have reproductive motives. But there's always a separate sexual identity there. And I kind of wonder if Vidal's homophobia kind of influences how he wanted to use eunuchs in the story.
Yeah, I can see that. It's just, you know, a true instance of how he feels about that sort of thing just leaking through, and him trying, you know, I think also finding precedent for it in like more of the stories of the Byzantines. And then again, laying that over onto an older empire that was actually unrelated.
Yeah, and I do want to stress that, like, I have definitely undersold the role of eunuchs in some of the stories. Though sometimes that's because, like, when Xerxes is assassinated, one version of the story has the assassin as a eunuch. And the other two versions, he has sons. So I'm going to guess he was fully functional. So I just opted to go with the two sources that agree instead of the one that doesn't, even though that one's more lascivious and therefore more popular.
Also, it was probably more popular with the Greek historians at the time.
But yeah, absolutely. Because look at these dirty, nasty Easterners. They cut off people's balls. Aren't they bad?
The Greeks. I'm gonna go with Vidal. I'm gonna go with Vidal on this sort of thing and say that we should be shaming the ancient Greeks more often than we do.
Hey, I mean, according to Herodotus, trans women exist because the Scythians plundered the wrong temple of Astarte in southern Palestine. And they were cursed.
I mean, it does feel like a curse from time to time.
Which is different from, I want to say, Ovid, who says it's because they drank horse urine. which actually might be true.
I mean, look, you got to get your estrogen from somewhere.
Yeah, because I mean, like, some temporary modern like estrogen supplement treatments are still derived from pregnant mares.
Good job, Ovid, on being sort of right about something once.
So like that, there might actually be something to that one, but I can't help but think that like some of the eunuchs in the story are just Vidal's own sexual politics bleeding into it.
I get
rampant misogyny, I guess, from somebody along the line. Like, I don't know if it's Vidal, but like the scheming harem women who are shuttered away from society. Like, I don't know where his personal takes and where, you know, 1,000 years of literature run into one another there. But like I said, that's just not what the system became looked like. All those women had their own fiefdoms. Yeah,
like they had land that they controlled, that like they were in charge of.
Xerxes' granddaughter controlled like large swaths of Mesopotamia, like in her own name, like hundreds of miles of riverland.
I think we need to point out that again, in most systems, being rich and powerful is more important than specifically the gender roles of your given society. No, I was gonna say, so like I think it was obviously not nearly so restrictive as Vidal portrays it, and two, whether you like it or not, these women were royals. They were the daughters and wives of the King of Kings. They were going to be doing stuff.
Yeah, there is an element of like rich people tried very hard not to be seen by the masses, but that's not the same thing as being forced away. Like, the men were doing it too, because if nobody ever saw you, that meant you weren't a day laborer. And the king and the generals had to compromise a bit because they needed to inspire loyalty from the people around them. So they had to go out and be seen in public. But like, if you could avoid it, you wanted to be as isolated as possible because that meant you were rich as hell.
I mean, that's also an expression of power that is a change you can see across the history of the Roman Empire during the Empire period, where the emperor goes from being like the first among citizens to becoming more and more sequestered from the public to the point where you can't even see them. Even if you're a dignitary, you might be able to see them behind a curtain or something, because removing yourself from the public sort of increases the air of speciality about you. So like late Roman emperors were significantly more removed from the public eye than, you know, Augustus ever was.
Yeah. The dominate.
Yeah, exactly.
Which actually triggered a whole weird transition in the Greek language where they didn't have a direct equivalent for the new Latin title. So they started calling the emperor the Basileus, which was the word for king. But obviously Roman emperors can't be kings, because otherwise anybody can just go up and stab them. So they they took the word rex from Latin and put it into Greek, because the emperor wasn't allowed to be a rex. Totally different. It was that word that he's not allowed to be.
Oh, love history.
But yeah, just bizarre. The one thing I want to tag on at the end of the harem section is just the extremely funny to me bit where they go to Miletus and Mardonius is freaking infatuated with Artemisia. Mm. Like Artemisia, the ship captain, cousin of Herodotus, who was the only intelligent person at the Battle of Salamis. And Mardonius has this giant crush on her because she's this powerful, strong, independent woman. But Mardonius's reaction is like, I want her so bad so that I can lock her up in my house and never let her leave. I'm like, is this the writing of a quote-unquote bisexual person who never had a serious relationship with a woman? Like, because this story point makes sense. He's attracted to her, so he wants to destroy everything about her that's attractive. And it's not presented as a conflict. Like, it's just presented as the obvious natural way of things in the Persian Empire.
She's so strong and independent. I can't wait to take all of those things away from her.
Yeah. He falls for her because she's this Amazon. And he's like, and I want to make her a housewife. It's like, Mardonius, do you hear yourself? Because Cyrus clearly doesn't, because he doesn't comment on it.
No, do the normal thing. And, you know, yearn after an Amazonian woman who's going to pick you up and throw you over her shoulder. And she's going to take you home, okay?
It is that plotline is a kind of funny inversion of the Atossa wanted Darius to invade Greece so she could get Greek servants, to Mardonius wanted to become satrap of Greece so that he could be closer to Artemisia all the time. Which is a fun twist on the same basic premise of the Persians invading Greece for personal reasons.
Yeah.
But like the book, to be clear, also covers the politics of it just fine, of like, there were lots of political maneuvering going on and Greece was this big distraction and very irritating to Darius and Xerxes for a long time. Though it does also act as the source for my least favorite book of the year's claim that the Ionian Revolt prevented the Persian conquest of India, because this is the only place in the world where that is presented as a fact.
Clearly.
Call back to my review of Lloyd Llewellyn Jones's book.
Yeah, clearly, if it weren't for the Greeks, all of northern India would have been Persian. To be fair, I think Cyrus Spitama...
There wasn't a giant empire.
To be fair, though, I think Cyrus Spitama in the creation would make the exact same argument.
Well, yeah. because the Greeks are liars and make money. Whereas the Indians are fellow Aryans who want to have more cows. Horses. And really, which one of these is the more noble calling?
Remember, it's more cows.
And yes, and cows.
Darius dreams of cows.
Yeah, right. They have more cows, and the sequence where like they chase a horse out of the city is a real thing from the Vedas. But yes, Darius dreams of cows. And so does Bimbisara. All of the great Iranian and Indian kings are dreaming of having more cows.
As all good Aryans do. This is where I make some sort of joke about return with a V. we should be lusting for more cattle all the time.
Yeah, but I don't know. Is there anything else in this book you wanted to talk about? Checked most of the boxes.
I do want to make clear that I think the premise is interesting. A lot of the writing is good. A lot of the stories are like sort of vignettes in this are fun and interesting to read. I think they just end up separated by a lot of filler that doesn't need to be there. And I do think the sort of theological debates genuinely would have been better if Vidal had let Zoroastrian belief actually stand up for itself, as opposed to making Cyrus Pitama a nominally Zoroastrian but functionally agnostic questioner. You know what I mean? If he had actually let the Zoroastrian faith's beliefs actually be debated with these other ones, I think you could have had a slightly more robust conversation. But I mean, generally, it was still fun most of the time. Thanks, Crusader Kings 3, for teaching me where my god is.
Yeah, I mean, like, that is why I suggested we do this, is because it's a cool book. It's, you know, it is, broadly speaking, historically accurate, or at least historically accurate as you could understand it when Vidal sat down to write it in 1979. Like, if you picked up a history book from the same period, completely nonfiction, it would have a lot of the same flaws. So, you know, I struggle to take points off in any real way for some of that. But I think we kind of come to this conclusion that a different interpretation of Zoroastrianism would have made the core theme that he was going for a lot stronger, because there would be more to talk about.
Because as we said, Zervanism, sort of the belief in you know, an independent Ahriman, or even the stuff that I think you put in the notes as being sort of the proto inklings of what would become sort of Mazdakism, all present a much more robust ideas than, you know, Cyrus Pitama does. But
I also genuinely don't know, like, maybe I'm wrong and he didn't have nearly as much access to information, but he was such a prominent guy that I feel like you've got the New York Public Library system and the Library of Congress at your beck and call. Like, you should be able to track down some of this information, but I don't know. I wasn't around in 1980.
If you really wanted to.
And I'm glad I'm not, because I would not be able to do a podcast.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm glad I wasn't around then either. But no, nothing. I got nothing else. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I did honestly, earnestly, even with my complaints, enjoy reading a book where I got to hear people actually reference, you know, the Wise Lord a lot. That's kind of nice. You don't often get that in many of the fiction I read ever, whether it's perfectly accurately represented or not. So, you know.
Yeah. I'm, you know, it was cool to be able to have you on for this, because that is a perspective that you don't get from a lot of people. And one of the reasons I might want to have you back to do a fake Behind the Bastards on a topic that is way too small for them to ever bother with, because I don't know, like, they still haven't covered George Bush.
Is the bastard going to be the specific high priests that killed Mazdak? Is that going to be our bastard?
I mean, eventually I will get to King Khusro the First on a Shirvan, but no. I want to talk about this dickhead priest in the 1700s. There's a lot going on in there.
I'll be happy to come back to that. Don't you worry. But thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, in the spirit of said podcast that I want to rip off, you want to give your pluggables?
Oh, boy. Oh, pluggables. As we said, I'm one of the two hosts of the podcast Sword, Sorcery, and Socialism. We sort of do the politics and themes inside of genre fiction, so typically sci-fi and fantasy. Going back and forth. We're actually right now in the middle of Cyberpunk month. We had about to put out an episode on Neuromancer by William Gibson. We're going to follow that up with Ghost in the Shell by Masamune Shirow. And then we'll finish the month with Snow Crash. We go through themes and then talk about, you know, fiction or sci-fi books that sort of follow those themes. You can follow the podcast, if you would like, on Twitter at Swords, the letter N, Sock Pod. Or if you really want to follow me on Twitter, you can at Herbo_Anarchist. But you should follow my pod. It's fun if you like fiction books. Trevor's been on multiple times.
Yeah, what? Two or three now?
I think three, if you count the Q&A.
The anniversary episode, yeah.
Well, I guess The Witcher was actually three episodes on the same book series.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Which, if you all love The Witcher, you should listen to our three-part series on The Witcher, which opens with Trevor talking about why unicorns make terrible slaves, because they don't have thumbs. But
it's true. Yeah. The innate ability to time travel probably doesn't hurt either, but
people should have considered this. But no, thank you for having me on. It's been a lot of fun. And also, I edit this podcast. So, you know, if you feel like the editing is good, you should let me know, because I like to know that I'm doing okay.
Yeah, as of episode 80 or something like that. Yes, Asha is my editor. Depending on how time works and strange corporate bullshit, you will hear this either before or after I do an announcement episode, because I am in the process of changing a whole bunch of stuff behind the scenes. But in the meantime, find me at History of Persia on Twitter, and all of the Nouveau Twitter post-Musk websites. It's the History of Persia. I just don't use them yet. And History of Persia podcast on Mark Zuckerberg stuff. Or historyofpersiapodcast.com, which is where you can get links to all of it in one convenient place, and also links to give me money. I think that's all I have to say about me. I think we've said everything about you. You guys have a Patreon. Search the name of their podcast on Patreon. They have really fun bonus episodes.
The Patreon podcast for Cyberpunk Month was on Akira.
And it's very good. I thought it was very funny, but I am in on more of the jokes. So I may not be a representative sample. All right, that's enough. This recording is too damn long. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye!
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.